So we'll join now the county commissioners meeting with Dr. Berry, with Willie Bentz, and the commissioners in progress.
Well, it's very nice to see you all. This is the first time I've seen you all kind of lined up together in the same room. So positive progress there. So updates on the COVID-19 front. We continue to see case rates and hospitalizations and deaths decrease nationally. We're continuing to move in the right direction there. For the first time since Thanksgiving, we've lost less than 1,000 Americans a day. Still very high number. We lost 796 Americans yesterday, and we've lost over 970,000 to COVID-19. But those numbers are certainly decreasing compared to where they were in recent months. We are seeing in some states in the country early signs of an uptick in cases, very, very small right now, but in some of the states that have been affected by BA2 first. In Washington, case rates are continuing to decline. In Jefferson County, we have diagnosed 3,176 cases of COVID-19. Our case rate remains in the low range at 65 per 100,000 with a 2% positivity, though we have seen a recent increase in the total number of cases each day. So we do anticipate that case rate will likely rise this week. Unclear yet whether or not we'll go over that 100 cases per 100,000 threshold. We have one of our residents currently hospitalized for a total of 115 hospitalizations so far in this response, and we have lost 28 of our residents. In neighboring Clallam County, we have diagnosed 10,956 cases. Our case rate is 91 per 100,000 in Clallam, and the percent positivity there is 2.4. We have two of our Clallam County citizens currently hospitalized for a total of 359 hospitalizations, and we have lost 111 of our citizens in Clallam County. So locally, we are seeing a little bit of a bump, which is not unanticipated. We expected cases would rise somewhat after we lifted masking requirements. It's too early to say whether or not this is a small bump that will resolve, or if it's part of a larger trend like what we're seeing in some other parts of the country that have been affected by BA2 earlier. We have only diagnosed one case of BA2 in our region, but of course, only a small percentage of our viral sequences, of our viral samples are ever sequenced. So I would anticipate that we are starting to see some BA2 here, though it is unlikely to be the dominant strain. Based on our sequencing, it's still a very small proportion of the strains that we're seeing out here. In Washington State as a whole, the percentage of strains that are coming back positive for BA2 is rising. So right now that's 28% of the viral strain sequenced in Washington State. So we do anticipate that BA2 will overtake BA1. For those following along all these letters and numbers that we use, this is basically Omicron, but a subvariant of Omicron, which is actually even more contagious than the original version, but it is not, based on current estimates, more severe. So we do anticipate that it will overtake the original Omicron in our region in the coming months, but it has not yet. The only other question I'm getting a lot from the general public is questions around whether or not we need a fourth dose, so an additional booster dose, and what the status is of the pediatric vaccine. I would say the FDA is meeting on the 30th, so that'll be the first time that we'll see a lot of data around both of these questions. Certainly, as a parent of a child under 5, I am anxiously awaiting a vaccine for that population as well. But it really will depend on what we see in the data. The early press releases about the data look good. They look promising. And so I'm excited to see the full data so that we can make informed decisions on that vaccine. I would also say that we have not seen the data yet on whether or not we need a fourth dose for the general population. I'd say it is very possible, based on what we're seeing in the UK, that the data might support an additional vaccination for those over 65. Right now, I'm not seeing any data to suggest that we would recommend an additional vaccine for the general population as a whole, but all remains to be seen once we see the data laid out in the coming weeks. And so with that, I'm happy to take any questions from the commissioners.
Any questions, team?
Sure, I'll go first. Great to see you, Dr. Berry. I cannot think of a better birthday gift for my absence last week than moving the community into the low status. So it's really exciting. I'm just wondering if there's any more distinction you can draw between the BA1 and the BA2. I guess I don't, it's a little more contagious. And so that's why it's going to spread. I guess this is really just kind of general interest in epidemiological curves and trends. And can you explain how a slightly more contagious one will end up being more dominant? I guess I just don't understand.
Oh, sure. So there are a couple different things that can make a virus kind of outcompete another strain of the virus. The primary one, the most effective one, is just being more contagious. So spreading more easily. If something is more contagious, can spread to other people more easily, it will eventually outcompete other viruses that came before it. Other things that can lead to a competition advantage include immune escape. So the ability to reinfect or to get around the vaccine better. So far, we are not seeing any evidence of that with BA2. So we're not seeing increased rates of reinfection beyond what we were already seeing with Omicron or increased rates of vaccine escape. It seems to be really primarily the ability to infect more people. And I think the key detail there is even with Omicron, we weren't seeing every single person in a room get COVID. It doesn't actually universally infect everybody, but if something is able to transmit to more people with a lower viral load, for example, that will give it a competition advantage. And so that's what we're seeing with BA2. We're not seeing that it's less severe than BA1 yet, but we're also not seeing that it's more severe. It looks similar in severity.
Great, thank you. And I guess my other question is, so masks, we can take our masks off inside. After watching your meeting, I went into a store and I bravely doffed my mask. And I definitely am still of the mind that if anyone is wearing a mask, I usually inquire, would you like me to put a mask on? Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm just wondering, in this new phase, is that pretty much what you would adopt right now? I mean, if you're a vaccinated, boosted person walking through the world, you can pretty much navigate without your mask unless you're being conscientious as someone who might be immunosuppressed?
Yeah, that's actually what I do. So if you see me out and about in the world, I generally am not wearing a mask in indoor spaces, with the exception that I carry one with me. So for instance, if I just went to a sandwich shop in Clallam County recently, and the person who was serving me had a mask on. And so I said, oh, hey, would you prefer if I put one on? And it's really easy to put one on in that kind of a setting and make sure they feel more comfortable in that space. Certainly if I see a sign on the door that says, they prefer that I mask, then I have one available for that. So I would recommend keeping one with you. There are definitely spaces where you'll want to put one on, largely for the protection of the people around you. And of course, always in healthcare facilities and still on transit. I am lucky enough to have access to my own vehicle, but if I were riding a bus right now, I would wear a mask, not just because it's required, but also because it's a really good idea. So if you're traveling, still definitely keep that mask on.
I will say I just took an airplane last week, and wearing an N95 for that whole journey was it was an imposition.
Yeah, it's not comfortable. It's not comfortable. N95s, for all the healthcare workers in the room know, N95s for a prolonged period of time are not a pleasant experience. I would say that the key time, because you are likely to need to take a mask break if you're not used to wearing them, is takeoff and landing. Whenever it says that you can remove your seatbelt, that's a good cue that it's a time that it would be reasonable to take it off. If for a period of time, put it back on, follow the regulations. But really it's in the airport, takeoff and landing when you need it the most.
Great, thank you.
I have a question, Dr. Barry. What do we know about the immunity conferred by natural infection from Omicron, the first strain, versus BA2? If folks had COVID, 2 and 3 months ago, very likely it was Omicron. How subject are they to reinfection with the new variant?
So far, we are seeing about a 90-day window of persistent immunity from prior infection to BA2. So the BA1 to BA2 coverage is pretty good. We're not seeing a lot of rapid reinfections for Omicron. We are seeing some, though. It does still happen. We've actually had a couple in Jefferson County lately where people have gotten reinfected within that 90-day window, but that's much less common. Generally, you can count on a good 90 days of protection against subsequent infection. but not permanent protection. We are seeing breakthroughs after that 90-day window.
And presumably less so if people are boosted. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So your best protection is to layer your immunity. So for the general public that's getting vaccinated, getting boosted, if you got an infection on top of that, you have basically the equivalent of a fourth dose of your vaccine. So pretty well protected. And particularly when we see that combination of immunity from prior infection and vaccination, that seems to confer a particularly strong immunity. But getting the virus alone does not provide you permanent immunity. Genuinely, you want to go forward and get vaccinated in that 90 days after.
Thank you.
I don't think I have any questions that you haven't already answered. So I know we got a few from KPTZ listeners.
Yes, so we got a few from our KPTZ audience. One question was, when will it be okay for a church congregation sitting inside to sing without masks? And I would say it is technically allowed now. Whether or not it's a good idea depends on a few variables. So this person noted that they actually have a very good ventilation system in their church, which is fantastic. That's going to make a big difference for reducing transmission. The other things I would consider when it comes to decisions around masking in church, one is the size of your church. So churches are highly variable. Some churches have 30 parishioners, some have hundreds. If you have hundreds of people indoors, I would still recommend masking in a space like that. That's just so many people that you increase the probability that someone in that space has COVID. And remember that singing, unfortunately, is the strongest activity for spreading COVID-19 that we have. We've seen the farthest spread of COVID-19 from singing than from really anything else. So I do still recommend masking in large indoor services where people are singing. I would say the threshold where it might be reasonable to remove masking in that space would be when we get to really truly very low case rates. So we get less than 50 cases per 100,000. I would say we're not likely to get there this week. We are seeing a bump in cases. We may well get above that 100 threshold, but there will come a time where we will get to that very low transmission threshold. And that I think would be a reasonable time to go ahead and unmask. The only other reason why I'm particularly cautious in church settings is the age of the population attending. Often, not always, but a lot of our churches have older populations attending them. And that's a group that we particularly want to protect. Now, one hopeful thing, if you're really looking forward to singing without a mask, is that we are getting to warmer times. And so remember, you can sing outside without a mask anytime. So if you want to move any services, any worship outside as things get warmer, that can be a really good opportunity for unmasked singing. A couple other questions. This person is 78 and has diabetes. They also have been taking some medications and they wonder if they should get a second booster shot. And I would say right now, data is still out on whether or not we recommend a fourth dose. It does depend on a little bit on your underlying immune status. So if you are immunosuppressed, if you're taking immune modulating medications, or if you have a genetic immunodeficiency, or of course, if you have an active cancer or have been treated for cancer, things like multiple myeloma, things like that, we do recommend going forward with your fourth dose right now to improve your protection against COVID-19. But for everyone else, if you are not immunosuppressed, we're not yet at the point where we're recommending a fourth dose. If we do, this person is very likely to be in the group that we would recommend it for. So people over 65, and particularly people over 65 with underlying conditions. But I would say hang tight. We're going to get to see a lot more data on that in the next week or two. And after that, we can make a much clearer recommendation for you. This person asks, is testing asymptomatic people who are coming into a shared indoor space worthwhile? And I would say it depends on the situation. One place, you can always add layers of protection. So day of testing is a really good way to know with some certainty that you're not spreading COVID-19 in that space. And I think day of testing really fits well if you have high risk people around you and if you're planning on doing a higher risk activity. So for example, you all want to get together to celebrate your mom's 90th birthday and you want to get 20 people indoors with a 90-year-old woman. It might be reasonable if you're going to unmask, have some cake, really celebrate, to go ahead and do some testing in that kind of a space so that you all know that you can have a safe party, you can take your masks off, and you're not going to give anything to a relative. So I would say if you have high risk status folks around, and especially if you're going to be unmasking in that space, adding testing can really add another layer of comfort and protection that is going to be a safe gathering. And of course, we do still recommend testing symptomatic people. Anyone develop symptoms of COVID-19, get tested right away. This question is, our household has 10 iHealth brand COVID tests thanks to the federal government. They all expire in July of this year. Has the FDA extended the expiration date on this brand? And they have. So the FDA has added a 3-month extension to the expiration date on all of the iHealth tests. So if you have one at home and it says that it expires in July, you actually have another 3 months beyond that based on current FDA recommendations. The only other thing I would say about your tests is they don't do well with extremes of temperature. So try not to let them get frozen or leave them in a hot car. But if you're keeping them in kind of standard room temperature, you should be able to get a good additional 3 months beyond the expiration date. And that is all of the questions I have from KPTZ.
Maybe one more question, if you don't mind, Dr. Barry. I saw in the New York Times today that the Biden administration is considering making available a booster for age 50 and up relatively soon. Is that confusing given the time frame we're in? I don't hear you promoting that. And I always have to point out as the youngest commissioner that I would not be eligible, although some of my fellow commissioners would be. Any thoughts on that?
Yes, I did note that, and I think it is confusing to the general population about how this all works. So I think the key thing to know there is that the Biden administration actually doesn't make decisions on vaccine recommendations. We have a team of scientists who look at the data on vaccines. So the FDA approves whether or not it's a reasonable option to offer. And then the CDC and the ACIP, the group that really looks at immunization practices in particular, makes a recommendation. And so that's the normal process. It's possible that what the administration was trying to do was make sure that they have everything on the ground ready in case a recommendation comes forward. But I did see that the wording was a bit confusing. So I would say right now, there is no recommendation for a fourth dose for the general population of any age. If one becomes recommended, it is likely to be people 65 and over. Possibly we could see a recommendation for younger groups who have significant underlying conditions. But the actual recommendation of 50 plus, that hasn't come down yet. And it's not really up to the presidential administration to do that. One key detail, though, is that it does take infrastructure to deliver that much vaccine. And so I think it is appropriate for the federal government to do some planning to be ready in case that recommendation comes down. And it's important to acknowledge there are some limitations on that now. So from a federal level, there hasn't been a reapproval of COVID-19 relief funds, which are essential for things like vaccine distribution and therapeutic distribution. So already this last week, we've seen a reduction in the amount of Paxlovid and Sotrovimab, so two of the most common treatments for COVID-19, into Washington state because there's no money for them. Those are all federally funded treatments. And when the federal government doesn't reauthorize additional payments for them, we see less of those medications come in. So I hope that will be solved soon because we are already starting to see the effects of that locally as well.
Thank you.
Is that a great segue to Willie?
Yeah.
Vaccine response, Willie? What do you think?
Thank you all. I don't have much of an update on this week. No KPTZ questions either. I did just want to plug our hotline here at the EOC. We haven't turned that off quite yet, even though we haven't gotten very many calls over the past couple of months, really. We did partner with Public Health to visit a homebound individual just a little bit ago to help get them a booster dose. And we continue to remain ready, available, and willing to help you out. if you are homebound, if you're a caretaker of someone who's homebound, or if just you have limited mobility issues and it's tough for you to get out to go and get vaccinated or get your booster dose. So do feel free to give us a call. That service remains available. And we are here to help if you do have, you know, questions or anything like that. So do feel free to give us a ring. I will say we are keeping our eye on the potential availability of fourth doses. It's really unlikely we're going to spin back up the mass vaccination clinics, given that those were primarily to deliver a large amount of doses relatively quickly when it really was an urgent situation. Case counts were high. They were providing a really vital protection to the community. When it comes to fourth doses between the healthcare sector, pharmacy, the infrastructure's a little bit more up and running and available to help meet the demand. Plus it's, again, not quite as urgent an emergency situation as it was before. So as we talked about, part of our transition from pandemic to endemic means that activity might be going away. So we're keeping an eye on things. We'll be having some conversations with Dr. Barry about what's needed to help deliver vaccine quickly, efficiently, equitably as well. But at this point in time, we don't have any plans once that fourth dose is potentially approved, but we'll make sure to keep you updated. Other than that, I have no questions from KPTZ. So end of my report, barring any questions from the commissioners.
I don't have any, Drew.
I have one more big question for Dr. Barry, I guess, if we have a few more minutes. Thank you, Willie, though. It's good to hear from you. It's just really wondering on the global level, you know, I mean, I used to play 6 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon, and I feel like I'm less than 6 degrees separated from everyone on the planet right now, you know. And I'm wondering, how are we doing on global vaccine distribution right now? I mean, we've seen what those gaps can create already.
Unfortunately, those gaps remain. There is more concerted effort on that front, partly because case rates have reduced here. And so that has freed up some of our national public health staff to start doing some of that work in the rest of the world. So there's definitely active campaigns to improve vaccine access around the world, but there's a large, large gap to fill. And so I would say that overall, much of the rest of the world remains under-vaccinated. And it is exactly the places that lack access to resources generally that are now struggling to access vaccination distribution resources. And it is really primarily the distribution and the campaigns, though we are seeing some areas of vaccine hesitancy as well. And that requires, you know, focused effort to make sure that there's a widespread population trust of the vaccine. So a lot of that work's going on, but we've got a big gap to fill and it's going to take some time to properly fill it.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Barry and Willie, for being here today. Oh, Kate has another question.
Thanks. One more, and this could be for either of you, I suppose. I think another gap that's identified is that there are a lot of Americans who are vaccinated but not boosted, and that's seen as a kind of low-hanging fruit for improving population-level immunity and individual-level immunity, right? So I'm curious, do we locally have a high population of vaccinated folks who are not boosted? What is the difference in immunity conferred for someone who had two shots but didn't get boosted? And then are we learning anything about how to reach that population? That's a population that was willing to get the first two shots, would maybe be less entrenched in a position to not get an additional one. So what are we learning about how to reach that population?
Sure. So in Jefferson County, actually, we have the highest rate of boosted population in the state. So we actually surpassed San Juan and King County in the percentage of our folks who got vaccinated who then went on to get boosted. So unlike much of the rest of the country, we actually are not suffering from that problem. So that's great. And that's really, I want to give a nod to Willie and his many dedicated volunteers who were a huge part of that work. And also the public health staff that worked really hard to get the messaging out to people that those boosters were really necessary. But I agree. I do think most people who are vaccinated are willing to get their booster as long as they know that they need it. And in Jefferson County, we're actually only a couple percentage points different between those who got vaccinated and those who got boosted. So blessedly, we are not suffering from that challenge.
Great. Glad to hear that.
Sorry, difference of immunity, just since you asked. What we see with the booster is a conference of longer lasting immunity. So we were seeing fading efficacy prior to the booster, and we're seeing longer lasting immunity in the general population, and particularly long lasting protection against severe disease in those who are high risk. And so where we are seeing severe disease, hospitalization, and death right now continues to be among those who are unvaccinated in the general population and those who are high risk and have not gotten their booster. We haven't gotten everybody. There are still some we find, and unfortunately, we often find out about them because they become severely ill.
And I have heard about I'm not sure what the nature of the medication is that allows immunocompromised folks who would not respond well to a vaccine, but a medication that provides some immunity. Is that available here in Jefferson County?
Yes, Evusheld. So it's a monoclonal antibody that is what's called pre-exposure prophylaxis. So it gives you about 6 months of protection if you're in that high-risk category. And I do really recommend it for those who are at very high risk. So particularly Jefferson Healthcare has done a really good job reaching out to their oncology patients. So those who are receiving cancer treatment who can't properly respond to their vaccine. We do still recommend they get vaccinated. It still makes a big difference. They get all four of their doses and then get a dose of Evusheld, but it has really provided a lot more protection for that high-risk group. We do have it here, and so if you are in that group, if you're immunosuppressed, if you're receiving cancer therapies, or if you are, basically those are the big ones, if you have immunosuppressed or receiving cancer therapies, if you're very elderly and there's concern that you might have some immunosuppression that's not properly documented, go ahead and talk to your provider about it. It can be a really good option to boost your immunity going forward.
Thank you. I promise I'm done now.
I'm going to pause for a second. Thank you, Dr. Berry. As always, we appreciate you being here, and you too, Willie.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week, if not before, somewhere out and about.
That's good.
Good to see you.
Thank you much.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting. A recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. Thank you for listening and for supporting your local community radio station. To make a donation to KPTZ, please visit kptz.org.